Cheryl Hotchkiss, the Vice President of Public Engagement and Awareness, is here with us today from World Vision Canada. Cheryl, are you on the line?
I am here.
Hey, thanks for joining us today.
For sure.
So what are we interrupting? Are you out gardening today, or is it a little too chilly for that?
You're interrupting nothing, because I'm actually nice and cozy at home, so I'm quite happy to be doing this. It makes me feel useful while being warm.
Oh, that's excellent. Oh, that's good. I was talking to somebody just yesterday who said they were going on a holiday. They were going on a holiday for a week, and they were going to be gardening for the whole week. That was their way of kicking back. That was going to be their holiday. It's certainly not my idea of a holiday. I'm more of the beach guy with umbrellas and my drinks kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
But so, Cheryl, you are an advocate. You have been working as an activist for many years. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how you find yourself as the Vice President of Public Engagement at World Vision in that role with a team educating Canadians? Can you tell us a little bit more how that sort of all started?
Yeah, sure. It's rather appropriate to the time that we're in right now with the midterm elections just still closing up south of the border. I would say that probably it started mostly when I was in university in my first year political science course, Poli-Sci 101.
Right.
And I chose to take on a project related to our electoral systems because I had very little understanding about the different systems that were out there and how they worked, and realized with shock and awe that the electoral system that we used wasn't exactly what I thought it was.
Right.
And this idea of, you know, the vote that you cast really has a lot of power and can really shape the government you have. While true to some extent, it also has a lot of conditions and formulas and things that I still don't fully understand. But I realized that the voice at the ballot box was just one voice and that and one opportunity to speak. And that I felt that because of that, it was really important to find different ways for Canadians, for civil society, to engage in the political process and engage power holders, because just voting wasn't enough, especially with broken systems. And I think certainly we can see evidence of that a little bit in the U.S. right now with broken systems, broken machines, broken processes that can impact the ultimately result, and it's important to stay engaged all the time.
Cheryl, I love the phrase "engage with power holders." To people who choose not to vote, or who just say it's too big, or it's actually not going to make a difference, can you speak to that a little bit? I mean, it sounds to me like you believe in the power of one, as do I. That sort of that incremental change. I mean, it's so important to write that letter, to raise your hand, to ask that question.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we all hold power. It's just a matter of degrees. Mm. And I think that there are those in society that tend to hold more because of their position in their society, the privilege that they've come to have, be it through their history or their legacy or their role or their family legacy or the income that they earn. Or in some cases, you know, the color of their skin and the opportunities that they receive because of that. So it's incumbent upon those of us that have more power to be able to exercise that and communicate what we believe to be how society should be functioning. I think sometimes I feel like we don't actively exercise our role as citizens, and not just citizens of our cities or our provinces of our countries, but citizens of the world. We all have the right to say something and be engaged. I may not always agree with what someone else thinks, but I'm very appreciative and honored when someone actually takes the time to be engaged in a respectful way.
Do you think people don't write those letters or don't vote or spoil their ballots because they, I don't know, maybe they don't like the options that they have currently? I mean, I've heard different excuses. There was a time, I'm going to admit it on air, I spoiled my ballot because I was this, you know, young student who, this was my way of, I don't know, putting up my dukes, I guess you could say, in some sort of relatively insignificant way, to say, you know, I'm not crazy about the choices, but I wonder about that, stepping into it versus stepping back, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think I wouldn't presume to judge a person's actions, such as spoiling their ballot, but I would hope that that wasn't the only thing that they did.
Right.
If they did choose that was, you know, they just weren't comfortable, but they were actively participating in the process, but made a choice not to participate at that point, I certainly hope that they would be doing things outside of that context to,
right,
to
like
sort of advocate.
Like trying to make things better.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think it's difficult when people engage in activities that are don't generate another action or just a reaction that they're being attacked. I think it's better if people actually participate and actively engage in dialogue and conversation. Mm-hmm. And I sadly feel that right now there's not enough conversation going on. There's a lot being said, but there's not a lot of conversation actually taking place. And so for me, in the work that I do, it's really important that part of the role that the team that I lead plays is actually providing people with information and ideas that they can actually then dig into further or make part of their arguments or participate in a conversation, as opposed to just state an opinion and then exit from the conversation.
Right. How would you define participation? And I've heard a rumor that you were arrested at a time. I definitely want to hear that story. That's participation, capital P. But, you know, the signing of a petition, the forwarding of an email, and I love what you're saying about conversation. Are you talking about that, I don't know, Christmas turkey dinner conversation? Or do you mean, you know, at the pulpit on a Sunday morning or on a radio station, you know, microphone? Like, is it all-inclusive? I guess there's a couple questions there, too, by the way.
Sure, yeah. I think it actually is all-inclusive. Mm. Every opportunity that you have as an individual to share an idea, ask a question, express curiosity, share information about something that people may not know about is an opportunity to engage in a conversation. Maybe not a dialogue in that moment, but certainly if you're on the radio or you're on a pulpit, you are sharing information and you're opening yourself up for conversation. But I think that there's lots of ways that we can actively participate on a daily basis, even in small ways within our own families, the way we discuss, as you say, at the table, around the turkey dinners. I think there's ways to engage in good conversation that facilitates learning, but it also teaches our children, as they sit and they listen, how we can be actively participating in the country that we live in the world we live in.
So to some degree, it's about modeling and mentoring.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's important for us to teach our children how to have good conversations. I'm afraid that sometimes given that conversations are often taking place online right now, we really don't have a lot of opportunities to show our children how you can have healthy debates, how you can agree to disagree and still love and respect the person that you're in relationship with. So the more opportunities we have to do that in our own personal lives, I think the better citizens we end up creating and supporting in the world.
So you've worked at a variety of different organizations over the years as an advocate and working in public engagement and so on. And I'd love to hear about that bridge from, you know, kind of poli-sci 101 to, you know, the Global South and how you wound up there. But I think the big question for me now is, are those signatures making a difference? Are people's donations are we moving the needle?
I think it is making a difference in at least two directions. I would say the direction of the power holder or the system that we're asking questions towards. I think we do see that our power holders are interested in understanding the mood and the concerns of civil society, and we see them reacting to it, maybe not always the way we want them to, but they still react to it, which shows them that there is some kind of conversation going on. Certainly, a petition signature doesn't do very much if the power holder doesn't find out that it's actually there and it's happening, and that's certainly critical. But I also think on the part of the person who's doing the signing or doing the donating, there's a transformation taking place in them as well, and they're actively participating in an exercise of saying, this matters to me, and I want to do something about this, I want to make a difference. And they're obviously engaging in an internal dialogue that's helping them to shape their views and perhaps change their own behaviors on a day-to-day basis. So it's both ways
Can you talk about how you wound up working in other countries, in many different countries around the world, or at least advocating on behalf of the Global South? So you started PoliSci 101 University, engaged and passionate and committed to the cause. Was it a trip? Was it a story? Was it more gradual than that?
I think it was a few things. I grew up on a farm in southern Ontario and was oddly part of a marginalized community in a way, because there weren't a lot of others around me. So that kind of put me on the outside of a lot groups. And then when I went to university, I really wasn't meant to go to university. I didn't have the grades, but somehow I managed to get there. And it really was that paper that I did where I actually got an A, which was the first time I've ever gotten an A in my life, that really then sparked the fires in me to say, I can be part of society and I can make a difference. And then from there, personal experiences led me to advocate on behalf of women who are experiencing violence, which then led to working with Amnesty International for 15 years, where I engaged in deep learning about women's rights and Indigenous rights and corporate social responsibility, and that then brought me to World Vision. And my reason for making that transition was really more about, I really believe in the work of Amnesty, and I really believe it takes all types of organizations to make change happen. But I felt that I was working sort of on the outer edges of change, where you were really dealing with policies and laws, which are critical to setting the stage for fundamental change. But I wanted to work a little closer to the source of the problem and to mitigate some of the aspects of where people don't have access to justice and where people don't have access to the system. And so coming to World Vision, and particularly working on behalf of the rights of children who are the most vulnerable and the most marginalized, was the journey that I took. And all the way through, though, the thread was really about people who haven't had the opportunity to be heard, bringing their voice to Canadians, and then ensuring that Canadians were being responsible when they've heard that message and doing something about it, and not sort of passively saying, that's too bad, I'm sad to hear that, but doing something to take action on that information.
What are some of the big wins that you've enjoyed, looking back over your career, working with different organizations, with World Vision in the last couple of years? Something, I don't know, that made you smile from head to toe. You stood up and applauded. Any big wins?
Yeah, I've really been fortunate to have lots of little wins and a few big ones. Certainly when I was with Amnesty International, one of the things that was really happening at the time that I was there was the fact that women's rights were not equal, seen as human rights. We came through the 70s and the 80s with certainly big strides in equality related to women's rights, but it still was seen as a separate rights issue, or a separate set of rights that were sort of secondary. And so I was very much a part of the movement in the early 90s and into the late 90s, where there was what we call the mainstreaming of women's rights, which right now sounds so odd to say it. But, those were the years of the UN conferences and the Vienna Conference on Human Rights and the Women's Rights Conferences. This was a whole building of the human rights infrastructure, so to speak, that still is working today in a different way, but there were many wins that I was able to be part of there. I can remember I was in China during the Fourth World Conference on Women's Rights, and we were in the NGO summit, which was very much outside of the main summit, and I was just very proud to be causing a little bit of trouble and a little bit of irritation on the side of of the organizers, safely with my colleagues at Amnesty and lawyers at our beck and call should we require them. But I can remember standing in a line, and I had images, in fact, of a woman from Myanmar, women who were standing up for their rights, the rights of their communities, and I was standing with others, and we were bringing their voices into that forum. So That's one. Working on Indigenous women's rights here in Canada and being part of the team that did some first early research at Amnesty on missing and murdered Indigenous women was a huge win. And then at World Vision, certainly the wins we've had at the G7s related to funding for children's rights, in particular maternal and child health specifically, and I think also bringing in a little bit of a new way of working within World Vision has been a big success, and getting detained, not jailed per se, but getting detained for a little bit of that activity. I'm kind of proud of that because yeah, I was helping an organization just kind of step into being who they could be, and they have seized it, and we've continued to see that the growth and the activism, both public and private, in that organization as a result.
Cheryl, I don't know if you know Drew Marshall or if you've listened to the show before, but he probably, if he's listening right now, and Shauna, who's running the board here, and a big shout out to Shauna for helping me out here today, make things run smoothly. She's pretty sure he's listening to the show somewhere in Cyprus, we think.
For sure. 100%.
And he's probably rolling his eyes right now, Cheryl, going,
oh really?
Here we go. Here's Peck again with his whole social justice thing. And like, for the love, like, why do I need to care about that? Why do we need to, you know, I've heard you talk about relationships as being just the fundamental, the starting point, the first thing. I know it's, sometimes I wonder if Drew just does it to push back because he can, but I wonder, how do you motivate? How do you get people to care about something that seems so remote and so disconnected?
Well, I think I heard a quote recently that has really resonated with me. Impression results in, without expression, ends in depression.
Right.
And I think we as a society, the more we learn about the world that we live in, the good and the bad, when we hear about bad things, we are human beings that are made to empathize and to understand. We're very emotional creatures. And when we hear about things happening to people and we don't have the opportunity to kind of express it and maybe even move beyond expressing it to actually doing something, I actually think it makes us not well. I actually think it makes us ill. And I believe that more and more these days, as a person who's spent my entire life working in this field, It's critical that I have opportunities to express those feelings and to have outlets to use my voice impactfully. And organizations like Amnesty and like World Vision and like Oxfam and Greenpeace, they're organizations that don't just ask you to sign a petition because they're just looking for something for you to do. It's part of a strategy. Mm. It's part of a well-thought-out strategy. And we on the outside only get little windows into that. But there are people on the inside that are working hard to position and to have conversations so that each time they reach out for that sort of civil society engagement, it kind of kicks you up into the next level of your strategy. So it's not just a flash in the pan ever. It's there's a well thought out plan behind it, and I really do think in this day and age where we have so much access to information, this impression without expression equaling depression is becoming more and more important.
Yeah, that's great. I love that impression, expression, depression. I'd like to see the PowerPoint slide on that one. It's interesting your work in Amnesty. You know, I and it just hit me as you were chatting about that impression, expression, depression comment. I was at a U2 concert. I'm a huge fan, and many years ago, and they've been supporting Amnesty's work for forever.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, not only did I become a letter writer, but it was a shout out of some kind. This is probably pre-social media. I think this goes back to the early 80s even. And so, yeah, signing a petition and becoming not only a donor, but an active letter writer. So public engagement actually can and does work.
It does. I've seen it work in terms of with Amnesty, certainly raising awareness of someone in prison somewhere and signing petitions and governments using their influence in those countries to get those individuals out. I've seen that kind of thing happen all the time. I've seen policy change. I've seen funding changes. So it's never a waste of time. If it's not just about the end result, it's also about your own personal growth and the community that you choose to associate with because you choose to take the action.
Cheryl, how does your, and Drew would probably want me to ask this question too, but I'm interested to know how your faith plays into this. And Drew loves to remind me that this is Canada's most listened to spiritual talk show. So I just want to get that plug in there for him. But yeah, how does your faith have an impact on this, or is it a driving factor?
Yeah, absolutely it is. I mean, I've grown up in the church. I've been a Christian my whole life. A long and complicated journey, but one in which underneath it all was always the reminder that, you know, that we're called to love our neighbor as ourselves. And that is the main commandment that we're called to do, love our God and love our neighbor as ourselves. That it all comes down to that. And when people around the world are not able to experience the love of their families, of their neighbors, because of what they're going through or because of something that's happening, it's my responsibility to do something about that. So, you know, Jesus is an amazing example of an advocate in a way that is beautiful and elegant and confronting. And he went to the places where the people who were on the margins of society, he stood with them, he talked to them, he made them understand that they're loved and valued, and I that sort of sits underneath everything that I do in terms of the journey I've been on in the social justice space and my efforts to lead teams and ensure that they know that they're loved and cared for as they do their work. So, you know, being a voice in Canada, communicating the stories of people that people may never get to meet, and having them participate in a conversation or an action that is about being that person's neighbor is just so validating and rewarding. I feel that in many ways, as a Christian, I have it easy in that I have lots of opportunities to share the love that I've been given, and I'm just very grateful for that.
Yeah, and we're back to sort of conversation, right? And we're back to relationship and all of that. Cheryl, thanks so much for your time today. I hope you can stay cozy, and I really do appreciate your time and your thoughts and your passion and commitment to the cause and to World Vision. Just as we end, is there anything you can plug? I mean, going to the giving season, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, certainly at World Vision, it's a big season for us to make sure that Canadians have an opportunity to give something memorable for the people in their lives. And we certainly have our gift catalog that is you can access through our main website at worldvision.ca. But I would really encourage people to be looking at gifts related to child protection, because it's something that I and my team are very passionate about. We've had the No Child for Sale campaign going on for some time, which is about child labor and child protection. And there's some amazing gifts in there that are really about dealing with the causes of why children are pressed into child labor, as well as helping those that unfortunately have been forced into that kind of work. So I'd encourage you to go there and show people that you love in your life how much you love them by loving someone else.
That's great. Thank you. Thanks, Cheryl, for your time today. We've been talking to Cheryl Hotchkiss, the Vice President of Public Engagement at World Vision Canada, here on the Drew Marshall Show.